And you're very welcome to the RTE Rugby Podcast ahead of the Autumn Nations Cup game against England this weekend. Round two for Ireland kickoff at 3 o'clock on Saturday. We'll have live coverage on RTE2 television, on Saturday Sport, RTE Radio and online as well. Delighted to say we have Donal Lennon, Bernard Jackman and Wesley Liddy with us to discuss Ireland against England, I guess, first and foremost. And we'll start with the team news. And Donal, just your initial thoughts on Ross Byrne coming in, because obviously the injury to Johnny Sexton and Billy Burns following the return to play protocols. But Ross Byrne it is who gets the nod, not Conor Murray at 10. God, think of that. And obviously Peter Armani being retained in the back row, but at 7, open side flanker. A couple of very interesting decisions, I thought.
Yeah, I think there is. Look, I think it was good to see, form from the last day was rewarded. In relation to certainly Gibson Park, I thought was outstanding in that game. Farrell had a decision to make around number 10, Johnny Sexton. When you tweak a hamstring, there's no way you're going to be ready to play international rugby in a week. I wasn't overly surprised that Ross Byrne has got the nod. I mean, he has been in the squad all along. He had been ahead of Billy Burns in the pecking order. We have to assume that Burns passed his HIA protocols on the basis that he is selected on the bench. But Ross Byrne is that bit sort of more up to speed, if you like, with the way Ireland want to play. He was in the Six Nations squad. And I think the fact that, he had decided to reward Gibson Park for his performance against Wales, so therefore having him play with Ross Byrne, I mean, they've played together with Leinster on numerous occasions. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. Obviously, I'm sure Ross Byrne, having won his first cap in that horrible World Cup warm-up game, just before the World Cup, and cost him his place in the World Cup in Japan. So that must be at the back of his head. But look, I'm delighted he's getting another opportunity. Up front, I think Quinn Roo certainly had his best international against Wales. And I think they're very conscious about the whole scrum. Obviously, the scrum went well in the game against Wales, but I think it's an area that England will target. And having Roo on the tight head side of the scrum there, I think certainly Andy Farrell will see that as a plus. Now, that said, I think Ian Henderson is ahead of Quinn Roo in the overall pecking order. So, but it is great to have competition there. Peter Armani, we'll have to see, is it a square peg in a round hole? Again, everybody writes Peter Armani off. I thought he had an outstanding game against Wales. Is he a 7 at this level? That's very debatable. And when you consider England are likely to start with both Tom Curry and Sam Underhill, so that's going to be a discussion for us, the amount of pressure that they'll put on the breakdown. They thrive off turnovers. So that's going to be an interesting battle there. But I think he's gone for physicality first and foremost.
Okay, we'll come back to Peter Manning in just a minute then. On the fly half issue, Bernard, I mean, rumours that Ian Madigan, Ross Byrne, Billy Burns, Jack Carty were all about to hand in their letters of resignation if Conor Murray got picked at 10, which was never really going to happen. But to focus on Ross Byrne for a minute, as Donald mentioned, he can't have happy memories of the last time he went to Twickenham to play an international test and the consequences of that fallout from that game. He was a huge part of it. Has he got the mental strength, and when Ireland put up a different kind of performance, that actually he can make a go of it at Twickenham this weekend, do you think?
Look, I think he's probably one of the most mentally strong players that is in Ireland, and he's been like that since a young age. So I think he'll be able to park that day in Twickenham. I think he was set up to fail in terms of the way the whole team performed, and obviously it has been a heavy week of training in Portugal, arriving in to play an England team who had a different strength. They wanted to be up and running a lot earlier. So yeah, I don't think he'll see that as being a true reflection of his ability. He's probably the most like-for-like in terms of a replacement for Johnny. And I think that's probably why Burns was on the bench ahead of him last weekend, as in Burns is a different type of player. So I think if you're going to start in Twickenham, he deserves to have a crack at it. And he's surrounded by probably a team better ready, better prepared to go to Twickenham than that last World Cup warm-up game. But yeah, there's a lot of competition. His own brother is putting up his hand as well, at provincial level, to maybe be someone who gets into that squad in time. But I wouldn't have any worries about Ross Byrne. And I know you said we'll talk about Peter Manning in a bit, but I think it's a sign of how Ireland are going to play. I think, England don't play wide. They play 30 seconds, and if they're not going forward, they kick it. And Ireland need to have a good set piece. And I still think Peter's probably one of the best defensive line-out options in world rugby, and he's going to give us something extra there.
Okay, let's talk about Peter then, right? Because, I mean, you brought it up, and it's very interesting. You know, you have to assume, or do we have to assume, that because he hasn't gone with the likes of Will Connors or Josh van der Fleer, that out-and-out seven type, that, you know, Peter Manny has been picked specifically to win as much possession as he can in the line-out, disrupt the English line-out as much as possible, and for what he brings on a physical sense as well. That he's not actually been picked to play as a seven in the sense that we know at Bernard. He's been picked because of what he can do in the back row.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's been the biggest issue against England. We've got bullied a little bit. So, you know, Quinn Roo should give us, you know, a better scrum. Keller will give us a better scrum for sure. And that may be enough to get parity there. And if we get parity there, that's a step forward on what's happened in the last three games against England and obviously the Leinster Saracens, which is probably their reflection of that. So, for me, I think it's horses for courses. It's not probably the way Ireland want to go, and potentially leave your van der Fleer. You know, we'll get the nod at seven for other games, but you know, this game will play between the 2-15s, and we just need to have a big, powerful, and aggressive pack with experience as we can. And there's some inexperience in other places, Kelleher and Quinn Roo, but yeah, they're both proven at this level, and you know, in terms of lots of games for the provinces, and I think it's the right call.
There was an argument, Wes, or there is an argument, right, among some people, that if you're going to leave one of the players that has been picked out of this back row, that CJ Stander is the most likely to miss out, because if you're going for an out and out seven to get around the pitch to chop down their big ball carriers, you might pick a Will Connors or even a van der Fleer. If you're going to have somebody to compete in the line out as a third option, it is Peter O'Mahony, and Caelan Doris just played his way into the team because of his performance last weekend. Are you surprised that he's gone with the back row that he's gone with, first of all?
I don't know if I'm surprised or I'm not surprised. There was a couple of ways he could have gone, and each of them would have been justifiable for different reasons. I think as far as CJ Stander goes, I think if you take last Friday night's game out of it, his form has been much better than Peter O'Mahony's over a prolonged period, and his work rate is phenomenal as well. I think with Peter, it could possibly, like, obviously the line-out is a huge thing. Defensively, particularly, he's not a specialist seven, but he is very good over the ball. But I think it's a mental thing and an attitude he's going to bring and a desire maybe to fight fire with fire as much as possible up front that sees Peter get the nod. Equally, you could flip that on its head and say Will Connors' particular skill set is very suited to trying to contain that English pack in terms of chop tackling and whatnot. But I think, like, there's lots of selections that you could go after the possible drawbacks of, but equally there's an upside to them. And I think for the first time maybe since Farrell took over, that you're kind of getting a sense of what he's trying to do by this selection. And I think he's as much as possible attempted to tackle that size and power deficit we've gone on and on about, but he's tried to do it without sacrificing an ability to play at tempo and an ability to put the ball through the hands as well. If you look at, like, someone like Chris Farrell would even exemplify that a bit for me. Like, even Jameson Gibson-Park is an interesting one. Traditionally, you would bring that higher tempo nine on to finish the game rather than start with it. And I know Bernard said their halfback partners at provincial level. So maybe that's why he went with Gibson-Park with Byrne. But equally, a part of me would go, well, if you've got a somewhat rookie out half, would you not have the 90-cap veteran playing inside him to guide him through the day, especially in Twickenham? So there's a lot of calls that I think you could easily have gone either way on. But I think all in all, I think it's an interesting team. And, you know, look, forewarned is forearmed at this point. They know what's coming with England. Like, so you'd have to expect at least an attempt to combat that. Whether it's ultimately enough is a different story.
How much, Donal, of what we saw Jameson Gibson-Park bring last weekend against Wales was because the Irish pack was so on top and because Wales have just faded in terms of their international strength? Or how much was it that this new number nine for Ireland is actually bringing something different in terms of the pace of delivery and the speed with which he operates?
Well, there's no doubt he's a different type of player to Conor Murray, but it goes back, first and foremost, to the quality of the possession that you're receiving up front. And Ireland just dismantled Wales in every facet of play. So therefore, it was an armchair ride for Gibson-Park. You know, he was on the back. Ireland, nearly all the recycles were less than 3 seconds. And that played right into his hands. So, I mean, you know, you're going to see a totally different like there's no way Ireland are going to have anywhere near that level of dominance against England. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's another reason why Andy Farrell decided to put him out there. Let's see how he performs under a pack who at best is going to break 50-50. Just stepping back again to the selection, I agree with Bernard. I think this selection is based solely for England because, you know, the last three times we've played them, they've won comfortably and they've beaten us up. If he didn't make some adjustments to the team, you'd say, well, what has he learned from those last three outings? I go back to that Leinster game, Leinster-Saracens after the quarterfinal when the Leinster scrum was under pressure with three of the front five who were starting on Saturday. First fellow I met coming out of that game, I did the match on RT Radio. Left straight away, I'm coming out of the tunnel after the match and the first fellow I run into is Andy Farrell. So the two of us look at each other and we're just there kind of, Jesus, the scrum. And it was, it was obviously a key issue in that particular game. But I think Andy Farrell, from that moment, recognised that if he doesn't get the scrum right, going to Twickenham against England, he's in trouble. And I think that influenced the fact that Kelleher is in and Quinn Roo. On the other side, I think Peter Romani, again, he knows England. They look to dominate through their set piece. They kick a massive amount of ball, so they don't play a massive wide game until the game breaks up almost, you know, in the third or fourth quarter. So therefore, if you don't match that early on, you're in trouble. There's no doubt that Peter brought a sort of just that bit of a manic stare with him against Wales that was needed, and I think Farrell was left with no option but to pick him for this game. And he still has options off the bench. So there's no question for me. It's a selection with this game in mind, but I think he'll also learn an awful lot from it.
Is, because England kicked the ball so much, Donal, is Andrew Conway very unlucky not to be on the pitch, at least, if not in the match day 23, given he is so good in the air and fielding high balls?
Yeah, I think he is. You're looking when picking the back three. The first fellow you were going to pick after last week was James Lowe, for all kinds of reasons. I mean, he just brings an energy that we haven't seen for an awful long time. He also, like, it amazes me how a lot of Ireland's wingers don't work off the wing. Whereas, like, James Lowe turned up on the right wing the last day when he was starting on the left wing. The English wingers do that all the time. Jack Nowell has a license to roam, as does Johnny May. So Lowe was always going to be selected. I think Hugo Keenan, who had been switched to full back when Stockdale pulled out the last day, I think maybe Farrell, he liked what he saw and he wanted to test that against an international side who we know are going to kick a huge amount. And Keith Earls hasn't played for a long time. So I think, look, you've got to read these selections in terms of what does Farrell want to get out of it by the time the tournament is over? How many players is he going to expose to action? Keith Earls hasn't been involved for a while either for Munster. He was injured at the start of the season. I can't remember the last time he played a game. So maybe he just felt it was his opportunity. Conway's played well for Ireland every single time he's been selected. So he might have it in the back of his head, look, that when I'm picking my strongest team, Conway is in there. I now need to find out, is Hugo Keenan going to be part of that? Or is Keith Earls going to be part of that? And he'll certainly find out and he'll learn a lot from the way this game is going to develop at the weekend.
What did you make of Ronan Kelleher's performance, Birch, in your position? Were you impressed by what he did on the pitch? Do you think that he is the long-term future in that position? And I suppose technically as well, with the issues and the question marks over the line-out from previous games, you know, have you seen enough to suggest that there's a lot to be positive about when we start with this guy?
Yeah, look, I think he's by far the best scrummager. And I know that Lancaster, you know, he was pushing for Keller to be brought through. He felt 2 years ago that what Leinster were missing was a big physical scrummaging hooker. And probably with Tadhg Furlong fit, you can get away with it. But when he's out, I think it's really important. So I think he will push on and become, you know, a regular starter there. He's powerful. And he didn't have a huge amount of opportunities with ball in hand at the weekend. But, he can get you over the gain line. He's pretty ruthless at the breakdown. So I like him a lot. And, I think he has the capability to go on and nail down that position for sure.
Yeah, and you know, the scrum is an issue, obviously. You know, it was for Leinster and Saracens, as Donal mentioned, the power that Saracens brought in the quarterfinals of the Champions Cup. Robin McBride, I think, has been outspoken about it, what he has done at Leinster to address what he feels was their shortcoming in that day. Will that transfer to the Irish team, do you think? Is there much interchange between the formation?
Well, no. So Robin basically copied what Saracens did in terms of their pre-engagement setup, and Leinster are now scrummaging like Saracens from a back five point of view. I think Ronan Keller was only on the bench against Saracens, and the damage was done in the first half. So I excuse him on that a little bit. I think John Fogarty has he's tightened up what Keane Healy's allowed to do. Robin gave Keane a license to be very, very aggressive, and he tried to walk around the cock and got caught. So I think they were aggressive against Wales, but they were certainly working together as a pack. And, you know, they got rewards for that. And you know, it was great to see an Irish scrum being able to win turnovers on Welsh feed. So, look, it's another step up. England left Macko and Kyle Sinclair on the bench against Georgia. I'd imagine they'll start. The worry for me is on the 55th, 60-minute mark when our starting front row go off and England can bring out a Skenge or etc. That'll be the challenge. If we're still in the game, can we get parity there for 80 minutes? But look, the start is to get parity for the first block when we have our first choice on. But it's still a worry, and it's going to be a worry until we can start showing we can. Like, we know there's a gap between England, France, and the rest. Unfortunately, Wales have dropped off a little bit, so this is a big test for us as a four pack.
Okay, well, let's hear from head coach Andy Farrell. He's been speaking to the media and reporters today at the team announcement. Michael Glenn asked if he can reassure Ireland fans that the performance we see this weekend won't be a repeat of previous failings against England.
You can't make promises. You know, I've not got a crystal ball. But what I do know is that this is a different group and it's a different game at the weekend. You know, like you've said, we've got new combinations all over the field that are coming together and learning from these type of experiences all the time. And they've trained well, prepared well, they can't wait to get out there and show what they can do. How that transpires, I suppose we'll have to wait and see, because like I keep on saying, a game takes its own course, doesn't it? And you've got to be good enough to make sure that you have a good feel of what is happening and be adaptable along the way.
Did the Argentina match, has that played any part in your build-up, the Argentina-New Zealand match? Have you spoken about that or gone through it and showed what can be achieved if you go out there with the perfect attitude?
No. We haven't spoken about it at all, no. This group has got guys that are unbelievably experienced in winning things, you know, winning a lot of things. And then again, we've got a completely different group at the other end of the scale that's very, very, I'd say, not as mature, immature in the international game. So that's where we're at as a group. We're concentrating on ourselves. You know, we gain confidence by how we prepare and making sure that we understand how we want to play the game. And that's how we'll be going into the game.
Andy, Michael Corcoran here. The word physicality is thrown around the place an awful lot when it comes to preparing for matches. We've seen the physicality of England. We've seen physicality of Saracens. Do you try to match what England do physically on Saturday, or do you try and make them think and do something different?
There's a reason why teams can be physical, you know. Teams that are physical tend to have a flow to their gameplay in the right parts of the field. We know that England's game is very much a territory based game, and they try and force errors upon you, and obviously play in your half. We weren't able to be physical in our game because in the last outing there at Twickenham, because they harassed us in many areas really, and we weren't quite clinical enough in our exiting, in our set piece, etc. And when things start to go wrong like that, the other team tends to get an opportunity to be physical. You know, if things start going our way and we are able to play on the front foot, I've absolutely no doubt that we'll be physical back at them.
You have to be smarter with your kicking game, particularly in the backfield, because that could be an in for them into launching counterattacks.
Yeah, it's something that we've spoken a lot about throughout the whole of this campaign, not just for the England game. and also being aware of what they're trying to achieve as well goes along with our plan.
Okay, so that was Andy Farrell there. Just let's talk about Wales briefly, lads, before we come back to Ireland. And Bernard, just while I have you, I mean, I was quite shocked at how poor Wales were in a lot of different facets of the game on Friday night. And it's very difficult to see where Wales can turn this around. Not that I'm saying it's all on Wayne Pivac, but I just don't know if they have the players anymore, that the standard is where it is.
Look, there's a huge amount of scrutiny and pressure on Wayne Pivac, and you know, the public and the media are going after him in a big way. I think it was always going to be very difficult to replace someone like Warren Gatland, who had 12 or 13 years stability. And I'll be honest with you, there was a lot of Welsh, there's a lot of times that the Welsh fans were after Warren as well. We only remember the good times, but there was little blips. Now, they haven't lost six, they never lost six in a row under Warren. But I think the natural end of that cycle was the World Cup. So Warren, you know, made sure that everything in his mind was to finish at a World Cup, and obviously they got beaten in a semi-final. But when you do that, obviously there's going to be a change, and you know, the key men for Warren: Alan Wynne-Jones, Faletau, Dan Biggar, George North, Ken Owens. You could argue that their best days are behind them rather ahead of them, and that's natural as teams change. But so Wayne has got to deal with that. He's also got to deal with the fact that, you know, the WRU implemented this player salary banding, which was highly contentious, and where the union set the value of every player and there was no internal competition. That affected the mood in the squad. There were salary cuts because of COVID, 25%. You know, the RFU went 10% deferred, and the regions are struggling. So, and also, you know, he's trying to change the way they play. Plus, their set piece is shocking. So the problem is, you know, they thought they could beat Ireland or be better against Ireland just by bringing more physicality and being up for it. You know, Ireland, they tried to pull and drag Ireland a little bit. Liam Williams starting on James Lowe, you know, Alan Wynne-Jones starting on Quinn Roo, which caused that first bust up. Ireland didn't take a backward step, but their defence was chaotic. You know, there was holes everywhere just because they brought line speed. And first, they only had two sessions to implement that plan. Their attack, you know, it's hard to see them attacking like Scarlets because they've no ball because their set piece is poor. So it's hard to judge Pivac, and it's like a perfect storm against them. Mm. He's talking around implementing a change of style. Yes, we can't even see it. If they were losing the game by playing a wide and having lots of possession and making errors, you'd say, okay, yeah, they're building towards that. But because the defence, because the set piece and the discipline are also poor at the moment, it looks really bad. And it's a tough one for him. He'll do well to ride it out, to be honest, because he'll be the scapegoat.
He will. And like, you know, it's not, we'll move on from Wales in a second. It's not like, you know, the regions are coming in and playing their part to kind of lift the mood of the nation. There's nobody going to see games. Obviously, even when without COVID at all, there's nobody going to any of the regions to watch the games, bar maybe the Scarlets. You have a situation where the Welsh team over the last few years in Gatland just lifted everybody in the country. And that's why the team were so popular. They kind of masked over the problems in Welsh regional rugby. Now it's all coming to the surface, Bernard, and there's no hiding room anymore.
Yeah, but look, there was always a risk of that. You know, when your house is built on sand, you know, you're always at risk. And it defied logic what was happening with Wales, given how poor the regions were. And now, obviously, it seems that they've dropped off another 20% and they're just not competitive. And, you know, that does affect the mood in the squad. There's the 60-cap rule. You know, so guys feel trapped. They feel if they leave Wales, they can't play for Wales if it's less than 60 caps. So, and then, as I said to you, you know, they feel that they're being hard done by in terms of financially as well. And you know, that's an argument that when you're playing poorly, you know, it's hard to make that argument. But there's definitely a mood of, definitely in transition, and it doesn't look great at the moment.
Just to bring, before I go to you, Wes, don't bring on this. Like, I know it's you know, we sit back and say, look, we were great against Wales last weekend, and that's nice. And, you know, when Ireland are doing well and the clubs are doing well here, that's great. But actually, you know, from a Six Nations Championship and from a European rugby perspective, we need Wales to have a strong side, don't we? And while we might say, look, okay, fine, the house is built on sand at the moment, they are basically reaping the rewards of complete failure over the last few years in terms of system and investment in the regions. I don't know, long term now, is this going to be the start of Wales having a drastic dip for the next 5, 6, 7 years? And what will that do for the Six Nations as a competition?
Well, it certainly doesn't look good. I mean, I was flabbergasted just how bad Wales were, just how flat they looked, and just how off the pace they were in the opening 20 minutes of that game. I mean, it was clear to see I think we were all waiting for a reaction, given that they lost at home to Scotland for the first time in 18 years. They'd been pummeled in the media and the press in Wales. So I was expecting this big reaction because they still had, I think, 8 or 9 British and Irish Lions in the team. Huge amount of experience. I mean, you'll remember, I was staying in the same hotel as Wales in the knockout phase of the World Cup in Tokyo. And I used to meet Warren Gatland a lot, meet a lot of the Welsh players. And it just struck me just what a happy, what a united group they were and how much, like, that Gatland got the absolute last ounce out of every single player. I remember meeting them. They had a kind of a little line-out drill on the morning. They were playing South Africa in the semi-final of the World Cup. And they had picked up a number of injuries. I think Josh Navidi was out and a couple of more players out for the semi-final. You just knew that they were going to turn up. And remember, South Africa only won that with a penalty in the last 5 or 10 minutes of the game. So they're on their last legs. I think Jonathan Davis played in that match with a bad knee injury, but he just felt he had to play. The following Friday, they were playing Wales in the third, fourth playoff. And they lost about 5 more players in the semi-final. They were literally down. And, you know, they were worried that they could be blown away. But it didn't happen. Now, New Zealand won well, but Wales came back really well in the second half of that game. All that resilience has gone overnight. But Gatland had, and we know those Welsh regions were, they've never won a Heineken Cup or a Champions Cup. It's years since the Ospreys won the Pro 12, as it was at the time. But yet they were able to rise above all of those difficulties because playing for Wales, that was what it was all about. Putting on the national jersey, this was the step up. Coming into Welsh camp was the breathing, was the lifeblood, if you like, of those Welsh players. How quickly that has disappeared has been a shock to me, to be honest with you. And but I also think there's selection issues. There's no doubt in my mind that the front five that finished for Wales was way stronger than the front five that started. So therefore, like, the first thing you've got to get right is selection. And Wales haven't done that. And I think Pivac, who I know him, I think he's a very good coach, but I think, unfortunately, he's backed himself into a corner now. He's going to find it hard to change the way that he plays, which we saw brought such success to Scarlets. But it's proved too big an ask, if you like, for, like, overnight, Wales have lost Rob Howley, Sean Edwards and Warren Gatland. At least Andy Farrell was part of that transition from the Joe Schmidt era. So he knew the good bits and the other bits. But Wales at the moment, it's, you know, you can see their regions are doing absolutely nothing in the Pro 14 at the moment. And as you say, international, the Six Nations needs Wales playing and being competitive. And the irony is, Wales now seem to be slipping just at the time when Scotland seem to be rising and are challenging for the top three. So, you know, it's a pity that we can never seem to get, you know, Italy will always be that bit behind, but the 5 of the 6 should be sort of there or thereabouts. But we don't seem to be able to manufacture that.
Maybe the most relieved man in Wales is Byron Hayward, you know, having been dispensed with, because his stamp is not going to be on this, what is a pretty atrocious looking Wales team so far, unless they can turn things around. Is the answer here, and this is the last point in Wales, are we going to see four regions into two? Is that what we're going to see to cut costs and to make the region stronger so they can be competitive in Europe and maybe feed some sort of a national enthusiasm for the game there?
Well, look, at the WRU were certainly in favour of the Ospreys and Scarlets amalgamating, having a super region West. The super region East were going to be the Blues, and then the Dragons potentially either stayed as development region or moved up to North Wales. That's what was muted last year. Ospreys have ended up finding a backer, but doesn't look like they have put the resources in to be competitive against the Irish teams. It's not just, you know, Donal mentioned the people who have left under Warren's regime, and Byron Haywood's gone now, but Sam Warburton, you know, pulled out a while ago. Ryan Jones was the head of performance, the same role that Nusafora has. He walked away. Pivac is trying to do that as well. That means he's ingrained in the politics of Welsh rugby, plus trying to solve on the field. The CEO has left. It's a real mess at the moment. So they need to get honestly, they do. I agree with Donal. I think Scotland have finally got their act together, and they're looking strong.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's pretty depressing if you're a Welsh rugby fan. Not too many listen to this, I'd say. Wes, just talk about Chris Fowle for a minute this weekend. The more I see of this guy in an Ireland jersey, the more I like, the more I think he can bring. Himself and Bundee Aki, for me, this weekend is very, very exciting. I'm not sure who they're going to go up against in the England midfield. But Chris Fowle, I mean, what do you think of him as an Irish international and a potential regular in that centre, regardless of whether Gary Ringrose comes back or not?
Yeah, I think he's definitely up to international standard. Birch obviously knows him a lot better than most people, having brought him to Grenoble. But, you know, I remember being over in Grenoble and meeting him when he first arrived there and just being struck by, he's absolutely enormous as well. You didn't quite realise how, well, sure, you were there as well. You didn't realise quite how big until you met him in person. But he's got the kind of the soft skills to go with it. And look, I think Ireland are a much better team always with Ringrose in it. I think he gives them something. So it's a very hard position to usurp for someone like Chris Fowle, but absolutely no concerns about him going in there to do a job.
And did you have a smile on your face watching James?
I didn't realise the three of you were together in Grenoble at the same time.
Well, I was stuck there. I had two uninvited guests. Yeah,
Me and Wes said, here, how can we milk a trip over to see Birch and have a few pints and do something for against the head? Chris Farrell's playing for them.
That must have been about 3 weeks after you fucking left the place, Birch.
We single-handedly brought him down.
About 6 hours of work and he got a inverted commas food poisoning at that point.
Terrible affliction that happens. IBS, it's awful. So, did you have a smile on your face watching James Lowe now that he had the green of Ireland on, Wes, as opposed to the blue of Leinster, where you just can't stomach the thought of him with ball in hand? Were you able to appreciate him for once watching him at the weekend, or how did you feel about it?
I appreciate him massively. I had to write an article during the lockdown picking the greatest professional era teams, and I picked him on the Leinster team ahead of Shane Morgan and Dennis Hickey and all these lads. But I do appreciate him. But would he be my favourite player in the country? No.
Yeah, well, look, it's fascinating this weekend. In terms of where England are at, Wes, like Eddie Jones, Georgia last weekend was a joke, right? And I'm like, I guess it kind of puts into context the calls for maybe Georgia to be looked at seriously as a Six Nations side. Don't want to be too harsh on them, but, you know, England just turned up completely disinterested and still blew them out of the water. But if Ireland can put it up to England this weekend, I think for me still they are the best team in the Six Nations. They probably should have won the World Cup. And if we can put it up to this weekend, would you start to think that perhaps Andy Farrell now is beginning to put a shape on this Ireland team and a plan in terms of what he wants to do after what was 6 months of us, a lot of us scratching our heads?
You probably would. And I think you probably have to say England don't quite look at full tilt at the minute either. And since Eddie Jones came in, they have kind of had periods of really trottling along, and then they kind of their form dips for a little while for whatever reason. You know, at one stage they were blaming the conditioning work they were doing. At another stage, maybe it was just form, but they're still formidable opposition. It's a bit of a phony war without crowds and everything. Sometimes you're not quite sure who's where, but it seems like France's trajectory is going upward more than England's is at the minute. It's terrible to be criticising a team or a coach when you're beating another tier one country by 30 points, but I think probably until you get a performance here this weekend and in games like this, like the morale seems to be very good and they're bringing a lot of energy, but you just wonder when they're matched physically and tactically, and in terms of the resolve of the opposition, you wonder about the detail that's there behind that. And I think that remains to be seen until we get a couple of consistent performances against top opposition.
Yeah, from an Irish perspective. Okay. Well, on that then, I mean, is it still a worry then that we're going back to the likes of Peter O'Mahony, that we don't have a clear understudy to Jonathan Sexton, that when he is injured, this is the guy who's going to take us forward? That we're still quite reliant on guys that we were reliant on 3 or 4 years ago. And a bit like the Munster conversation, should we not be investing more in youth and bringing them through now ahead of a World Cup in 3 years' time?
I think Bernard and the lads were saying it on Against the Head on Monday about looking at the 10. And, you know, Stephen made the point about, you know, when he first came into the Ireland team, you had Humphreys and Raj, and then you had Raj and Sexton, and that, you know, maybe now Johnny isn't benefiting from... He's almost too dominant, and maybe you would prefer a stronger competition there. But Perhaps the next long-term out half is one of the much younger guys like Harry Byrne or like Ben Healy or Jack Crowley, maybe. Rather, maybe Ross Byrne suffers from timing a little bit, and that he comes along in the shadow of Johnny, and the guys underneath him maybe will be the ones to benefit from that down the line.
Yeah, Donald, you know, if Ross Byrne was good enough, I think, and like this, no disrespect to him, he would have stamped his place as the clear second choice fly half. He hasn't done that. Maybe a little bit unlucky at times. You can make excuses for him, sure. But, you know, do we not need to be bringing out, rolling out the new young faces now? Give them a couple of years, and by the time the World Cup comes around, we have a strong squad of young guys with a heap of caps under their name, and we have a squad to win the World Cup and contest for it.
Yeah, we do. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, you go back even before when David Humphreys came on the scene, Eric Elwood was the man, and they were having that same battle. So you can go back 25 years. The whole professional era for Ireland, you've had an established 10 with a very good young guy coming through, putting the pressure on. This is the first... Well, you see, I think it was we were in place for that to happen. I mean, you go back 4 years to the tour of South Africa. Paddy Jackson was seen as the heir apparent. Obviously, the fallout from the Belfast trial. He hasn't played for Ireland anymore. Then Joey Carberry has come through. There is no doubt in my mind that Joey Carberry would be the heir apparent had he not got injured pre the World Cup. So therefore,
really forgot about him.
There is. That's the whole point. Everybody seems to have forgotten about Joey Carberry. But there is a void because, let's say, the next layer of player who would have been ready to step up behind Johnny have fallen away for one reason or another. So now you have Ross Byrne as the second in command at the moment, but because they were both in Leinster, he hasn't got as much top class games. I'm talking about Champions Cup as opposed to a lot of meaningless Pro 14 games. So, you know, he's now been asked to perform at international level, where he started very few. I know he started a couple of Champions Cup games for Leinster, but, you know, it's a massive step up. So that is an issue for Ireland at the moment. There's no doubt about that. And I don't think it's doing Johnny Sexton any good either, because you could see how having the pressure, somebody biting at your coattails. He did it for O'Gara for long enough, and the rivalry and the intensity that was between the two of them. You go back to that documentary RTE brought out after the World Cup in 2011, when you, the two boys in the back of the taxi going for their place kicking practice, one fella staring out one window, one fella staring out the other window, no conversation. That drives people on.
But on the Joey Carberry issue, if this guy doesn't play again, and look, I don't want to be overdramatic here, but if Joey Carberry has sustained a serious enough injury where his career will not be the same again, or certainly not as was hoped for, there has to be serious questions about why he was ever brought to Japan in the first place. I mean, what looks now to be have been a risky call, now with the benefit of hindsight and more time, seems like an absolutely ludicrous call for his benefit.
Yeah, look, I remember when it happened, the game against Italy, it looked like a really serious injury at the time. I remember saying in commentary, look, that's his World Cup gone. I think if people had their time all over again, there is no way he'd have gone to Japan. I mean, you could then go back to the key pool game against Japan in Shizuoka. And he didn't even start that. Jack Carty started that day. And to be fair to Jack Carty, you remember, we were there. He had a really good opening half hour of that game. Yeah. Ireland lost their way as the game went on. He seemed to pay the biggest price of all. There's no question Jack Carty's form suffered after the World Cup. And sure, he was left out of the Connacht team for a while was it Conor Fitzgerald, who had just come up as a sort of a sub-academy player out of Munster, ended up getting starts for Conor. So, the fallout from that World Cup with both Joey Carberry and Jack Carty, it both cost them in many ways. So that void is there, and it's look, you're going to have to close it and close it quick, because Johnny Sexton isn't going to last forever.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the fact that even Conor Murray-Birch was mentioned as a kind of a throwaway remark, but the fact that Andy Farrell had to answer it with a serious face said, I guess, you know, really where we are at with our kind of strength and depth at fly half. Look, it'll be interesting to see how Ross Byrne goes on this weekend. You mentioned mentally how strong he is, and he's got to get himself right. Who do you expect England to go with, Owen Farrell, or do you think that George Ford will be picked up at that 10-12 combination?
Yeah, and no, I think they'll start Farrell. They may start both against Ireland, has worked well in the past at 10-12. Yeah, look, at England are in a good place. I know you know, people are criticising their form, and Eddie's getting criticised about how much they're kicking the ball away. But he's a paint-by-numbers coach, and he backs the trends, the data, and he's absolutely convinced the teams that kick the most international rugby win. And, you know, they won 40-0 against Georgia. Georgia were poor. They weren't convincing against Italy. But he copy and pasted the same game plan. And I think the reason he does it is he feels the more they practice that, the better equipped they're going to be to beat the New Zealands, the Argentinas, the Ireland. So, I think, you know, Andy Farrell knows what's coming. He's faced it as a defence coach 3 times in the last 18 months. And, you know, it's going to be more of the same. We just got to try and make sure we have a plan that can counteract it. Because if not, if we start giving them that space in the backfield, they have been finding we're dead.
Okay.
Isn't it the same argument, Birch, that you go back to 2018 when Ireland had that magnificent season, beat the All Blacks in Dublin, won the Grand Slam, had that tour of Australia as well, won the series down there. People were giving out about the style of Irish play. Do you know what I mean? They're winning. Like, what would you do to have that sort of win ratio? No, it's the exact same thing with England at the moment. They won their third Six Nations in 5 seasons. They're delivering. They got to the World Cup final. And people are giving out like mad now about their style. They're kicking too much. They're playing too much of a set-piece orientated game. But it's delivering for them. And why? And I remember having this argument when Joe Schmidt was running the Irish team. Of course, everybody'd love to be winning by playing, you know, flashy rugby, getting the ball to the wings, offloading, you know, scoring tries from 50, 60 metres. Brilliant. But that's the way New Zealand play. And New Zealand are better than that than we are. That's the way Australian play. Why should we ape what they do if we are stronger in an area than they are? And I think that is the exact same argument that Eddie Jones would make about England now. He is looking, what is England's identity? What are the things that they can do better than New Zealand, South Africa or Australia? And he's identified that power game, their kicking game, their strong defence, and their ability then in terms of their bench. He was the first fellow to call the bench finishers going back 4 or 5 years ago. So that has been his model. It's working for him. Yet, people are still giving out.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, I think one of the highlights of the weekend for many people, as just to move on a bit, was we all found out the key to beating New Zealand is to run circles around your apartments, to run out to the back door, to throw balls up onto the roof where your outlad is waiting to practice for the line-out. It's as simple and as basic as that. Whereas, in fairness, it was the feel-good story of the weekend. Mario Ledesma, I think the closest I've seen to tears on his face is when he was scrunching the opposition in the front row and their tears accidentally batted onto his cheeks. He was so emotional. And it was brilliant to see, wasn't it?
Ah, excellent, yeah. Yeah, brilliant. And, like, we've obviously had a lot of rivalry with Argentina over the years and, you know, threw all sorts of accusations at them, probably founded in many cases. But when you're objective about them, when they're at their best, they do bring brilliant passion to the whole thing, and it's hard not to respond to it. But, like, if you think Ireland and Wales and England, as Donald was saying, have been getting a bit of stick... the last while, I wouldn't fancy being in that All Black squad at the minute. What's coming at him, I'd say.
Yeah, well, I think the question marks over who should have been appointed head coach. But, like, you look at that Pumas performance, Birch. Again, I took back to Donald's point there just a minute ago. The mantra has always been you got to score tries to beat New Zealand. Well, they scored one try, but they kicked the rest of the points. They made one handling error in the entire 80 minutes, Argentina, which, when you think of they haven't played a game in a year, is just a freakish performance.
That's phenomenal, and I think there's a lot of structural things happening in Argentina, and, you know, the players have been advised to go get contracts in Europe if they can, which is, goes against what was the case. But there's no better team in the world to use a rallying point or chip in your shoulder, and they probably lost that. You know, you look back to the team that Pichot and Ledesma played in, where they're fighting for tier one status for proper competitions. And they got it and probably didn't take advantage of it, but that's a huge step forward from what we saw on Saturday. Michael, check in the back room as well. adding to it.
But, enjoy that.
Yeah, he enjoyed that for sure. And him and Ledesma are obviously very close. It was the other way around. Ledesma was his assistant. Now Ledesma's the boss with Cheka helping. But yeah, look at it. It's brilliant. And their defensive performance was incredible. But yeah, there's a lot of people, as Wesley said, in New Zealand talking around you know, Wales are saying that they want Scott Robinson to be their new coach, but he might sense that there's maybe an All Black job coming up sooner than he thought.
Yeah. Yeah, they won't tolerate that kind of performance. Donal, as you made the point in your Irish Examiner column, that why would anyone now want to draw Argentina in the World Cup? I mean, they're not an easy side, never have been, but particularly now, they're the nightmare draw, aren't they, in the World Cup pool?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're in band three of the draw. We're in band two. So you could end up with New Zealand or South Africa and Argentina with only two teams to come out of the pool. But like, I have to say, I admire Argentina against... everything is against them all the time. You know, they finally, after 2016, they got into Super Rugby. The Jaguares, everybody came back home. And while it was brilliant on one end in that they had a provincial side that was playing against the very best from New Zealand, South Africa, Australia, I actually thought it proved a bit counterproductive for them on the international stage, because in the end, the Argentine side was almost exclusively the same as the Jaguares, because they weren't considering overseas-based players. And yeah, the strength that Argentina had for years in those World Cups against Ireland in the 90s and into the noughties, the strength they had was the fact that all their players were scattered all over the world, and they came together for a World Cup. They had maybe 2 or 3 months to prepare in advance, so they had more preparation time than they would for any normal game. And just the sheer joy that they have in playing for their country and coming together for a tournament like that just brings them on to a different level. So they had lost that for a little bit, I think, given that everybody, they were all the same players meeting in camp with the Jaguares every week. Then they'd go away, the same group of players, almost bar one or two on the international stage. Whereas now they have a cause again. They hadn't played for 402 days at international level. Australia and New Zealand have just decided themselves that Super Rugby is now going to be the sole preserve of 5 teams from New Zealand, 5 teams from Australia. So all of a sudden, Argentina have nowhere to go. So their players are going to have to go to Europe again. And if you were a scout or Europe, you know, you're a club coach looking at that game last Saturday, I mean, Argentina had a couple of younger players that... I mean, they'll be scooped up straight away. But, you know, how good is that for Argentinian rugby in the longer term? Again, you know, I think it's a point, world rugby. It's difficult from a geographical point of view because they're so far away from everyone else. You know, how you get the perfect scenario for them. But look, I think the collective will and the drive they had to win that game, and to see their, you know, the lads who weren't involved, their players who weren't in the match day 23, to see them dancing and hollering and jumping. They were like a crowd of schoolboys left out for the day to go to the match. Yeah. I mean, it was inspirational.
I have to say, but the captain Pablo Montero has a fierce head of Wes Liddy, I thought, on him. No? Does anyone else think that? No? Just big, rough, absolute brute looking lad.
A
bit more talent, though, I'd have to say. A bit more talent.
No, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. And, like, you know, Wes, this is what I was thinking, Donald's point there. If those players who used to play with the Jaguares are forced to go off to Europe or to go to other clubs to look for professional contracts, that actually might, in a perverse way, make Argentina more dangerous when they do come back together, because they will be playing at a higher standard among the top level in France, or say even in England or whatever clubs they can find. So they're playing at the top level of club rugby in Europe or in the Southern Hemisphere if they can get it. And when they do come back together, they'll have this incredible bond that Argentina just have when they reform, having not seen each other. They're back playing for their country. It could make them really, really dangerous come the World Cup.
They're definitely dangerous. I mean, they're well gone beyond, you know, kind of having an odd flare up here and there. Like, they're producing players constantly. There is obviously geographical issues, but I think, to be honest, in terms of if you're looking 3 years forward at this point and how teams are evolving towards the World Cup, I think New Zealand probably are nearly at more of a crossroads than Argentina in a funny way. And it's not to be over dramatic on the back of one game. There was a clear choice. It wasn't just about Foster versus Robinson after the World Cup. I think, like, Steve Hansen had been in that setup, you know, in conjunction with Graham Henry, Wayne Smith, different people for, you know, pushing 20 years, and they'd kind of re-established the whole way they did things and the culture that was we heard so much about. And, you know, there was always a temptation to kind of just tweak things rather than radically change them. And they probably got their timing wrong into the last World Cup. they thought some players would maintain their high performance right through it. Like people like Kieran Reid were maybe at their peak two years out from the World Cup. They stuck with guys and maybe the next wave of replacements of those missed the boat now. And with the result being that the need for a rebuild, you know, in relative terms for New Zealand, because they're always pretty strong, has grown. And maybe the current management isn't equipped to do that because their MO is very much to proceed along the basis of what's worked over the last 10 or 15 years. So maybe they've gone down a route that they can't really turn the ship around on too easy. Now, they're still going to be in the top two or three in the world regardless, but to get the absolute most out of themselves, you know, I wonder, are they questioning some of their choices now?
Yeah, and we'll wait and see what happens over the next few months, I suppose. All right, lads, I'm not going to ask you for a prediction because we don't have an England team, so it would be pretty pointless asking. But just before we go, one area each that you'd like to see Ireland, you know, show up this weekend and actually put it in. For myself, obviously, I just hope that Ross Byrne has an easier time of things than he did last time he went to Twickenham, because I think he deserves it for the work that he's put in and the professionalism he showed. I'd like to see him have a decent game. Birch, where's the one area you'd like to see Ireland show up this weekend?
Just dealing with the backfield issue, they find grass way too much. They have found grass way too much in the last three games, and we need to make sure that we're more proactive in terms of covering space.
Okay, Donald?
I think, look, it's the battle for the gain line for me. You know, it's been said on many occasions, England have won that physical battle hands down in the last three games. That's where the game starts and ends for me. Ireland have to meet them there. And, you know, stop the Vinnie Bulopolas, the Maro Atoges dictating the game. If they do that, I think they'll be well in for a shout. I think it's one of those games where the performance is almost more important than the result.
Okay. And Wes, what do you want to see this weekend?
Like the younger guys, I think Doris and Kelleher and Keenan and, you know, to be the players that we think they could possibly be against the lead opposition, it'd be very positive going forward.
Okay, I think we've just about covered everything. Ireland, England this weekend, problems for Wales, problems for New Zealand, a resurgent Argentina. Unfortunately, no time to cover the Pro 14, but sure, look, that's the way life goes. We'll talk to you next week. Enjoy the match.